where and a voice came now, where Daniel will have a variety of different visions. There are angels that show up. Daniel sees monstrous things and crazy animals and all sorts of stuff. And obviously we'll talk more about those as we get to that part of the text. We'll talk about what apocalypse is as its own genre, what you can expect to see in that kind of genre. This is something that during the intertestamental period, the Jews just wrote all sorts of different apocalyptic books. And so it is an established genre, which has its own unique traits and such. So we'll get to all of that later on. So this is your basic division of the book of Daniel. If you're thinking, how is Daniel divided? This is what you're probably going to think of first. There's the normal part and the weird part, right? The part you know and the part you don't know nearly as well. Again, broad brush speaking, that's the case for most people. There are also linguistic divisions of Daniel, which doesn't come through to us because it's all in English when we look at the book of Daniel. But it is written in two different languages in three different parts. Chapters 1 through the beginning of 2 is in Hebrew. Picking up there in the middle of verse 4 through the end of chapter 7 is in Aramaic. And then 8 through 12 is Hebrew again. And this is one of the weirdest things that shows up in the Bible, at least in terms of it being written the style's one thing to change the language. I'd say in the middle of a verse, but of course the verse divisions weren't there originally. But in the middle of a scene to change the language, and then it just continues on for a really, really, really long time and then jumps back. What is going on in that regard? Well, to some degree, it's impossible to know what's going on because the author didn't say, oh, by the way, here's why I'm changing to Aramaic, and here's why I'm changing back to Hebrew. There's no explanation given for it. One of the suggestions that has been made over the years is that Aramaic is the more universal language, Hebrew is the more localized language. Aramaic became the imperial language of the Persian Empire at some point, and it held strong for a very long time. The Jews in Jesus' day were still speaking Aramaic rather than Hebrew. In its normal sense, even when the New Testament talks about speaking in the Hebrew tongue, that's kind of New Testament shorthand for Aramaic is what they were almost certainly speaking then. And so it was a more universal language. Not everyone knew Hebrew. And so what has been suggested is if you really look at it, chapter 1 and chapters 8 through 12 are focused on the situation and the fate of the Jewish people, particularly in chapters 2 through 7, are much more broad and international in their scope in dealing with big picture world sorts of issues. And so it would be appropriate for the Jewish specific part of the book to be in Hebrew and the more broad part of it to be in Aramaic. That's true. Is that why it was done? I don't know. Like I said, I don't know that you can prove anything here except that it is just this way. It's also possible, we don't know exactly when the book of Daniel was written, all of it. The latter section, 7 through 12 here, to go back to that first list there, 7 through 12 is in the first person, and so presumably Daniel's the one who wrote that. But 1 through 6 is in third person. Daniel's a he, not an I. Now, is he possibly writing about himself in the third person? Yes, he is. Or could it be a different narrator who is telling us the story of Daniel, and Daniel tells us the visions of Daniel, and through inspiration it was all put together, presumably by the person that wrote the first six chapters, brought in Daniel's own revelations there. Again, we don't know all of the details of all of this, but it's possible that some of this was kind of its own independent story. There was the Aramaic section that was circulated as its own information before the book came into its final form as we know it. We just don't know all of the answers to all these kinds of things. Now, what is significant about this and significant about something else that I'll show in a moment is Daniel's one of those books that you have to be very careful who you read on the book of Daniel, because there are some wild theories about the book of Daniel in all sorts of different directions. One of my favorite little books on Daniel says that he was very resistant to write at all about Daniel because it's way too easy to be labeled either with the kooks or with the nincompoops. You know, no matter what you say, you're going to upset somebody because there's so many different weird things out there about the book of Daniel. It's like Revelation in that regard as well. So you've got your dispensational premillennialism on the one hand. You've got your non-believing liberal scholars on the other hand, and a whole host of everything else in between. So you got to be careful about what you read on Daniel. But when you talk about those liberal, critical, unbelieving scholars, if you read any of their stuff, one of their basic presuppositions is that there is no such thing as the supernatural. Why are you studying the Bible then for a living? Different question. But there's no such thing as the supernatural. Predictive prophecy is impossible, therefore. And so all of these prophecies of Daniel 7 through 12 can't be real prophecies. They're history written after the fact, posing as prophecy. And so the way they divide the book of Daniel is in two parts. This is all getting somewhere in a second, I promise. The way they divide the book of Daniel is in two parts. These first two basic parts, chapters 1 through 6, are kind of legendary stories about this guy named Daniel. Maybe they're true, maybe they're not. Maybe there's a kernel of truth in them. But there are these legendary stories. And then chapter 7 through 12 is history posing as prophecy written by someone in the Maccabean time period. Now, the reason I bring all of that up is notice that the language break doesn't happen at the end of chapter 6 before chapter 7. Which you would expect if somebody is taking some old Hebrew stories and writing some new Aramaic stuff, that chapters 1 through 6 would be in Hebrew and chapters 7 through 12 would be in Aramaic. You wouldn't have the language divisions broken up like this. It doesn't match that theory to divide it that way. Now, not only does this not match that theory, neither does this. This is one of our literary structures. I'm going to show you a few of these. Different ways that people have suggested the book of Daniel has been put together. This is the one that I think is the most compelling of the entire book, and then there are a couple that go with just chapters 2 through 7 as well. So, it begins, well, that's tiny, it begins with what is an introduction to the entire book, the prologue of the story, chapter 1. Daniel and his friends are brought into captivity. You're introduced to them. You're introduced to their situation. You're introduced to the God who is behind the entire book. We'll have plenty to say about chapter 1 next time. And then, beginning in chapter 2, you've got this chiasm, or chiasm, depending on how you want to pronounce that, of a dream in chapter 2 and a vision in chapter 7 of these four kingdoms or four kings that are going to arise and an interpretation about that given. So those two chapters obviously match pretty well with each other. Moving in a little bit, you've got the fiery furnace in chapter 3 where God delivers the righteous from death. The lion's den in chapter 6 where God delivers the righteous from death. Two miraculous stories of deliverance. Probably the two most famous stories in the book of Daniel as far as that goes. And then you've got two proud kings who were judged and humbled in chapters 4 and 5. Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, Belshazzar in chapter 5. Both of them are disregarding God and lifting themselves up. Nebuchadnezzar by going, hey, look at this fantastic Babylon that I built all by myself and how wonderful I am and how beautiful my city is. And you remember what happens to him. Belshazzar, who says in his great party, which is a going away party, not just because that's what happens, but probably because he knows that's what it is. We'll talk about that when we get to chapter 5. He says, go get those temple vessels that Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple of Jerusalem, and we'll be drinking our wine out of those today. Well, he's lifted himself up against God as well, and he is humbled there. So this is, I think, a very fantastic structure. I don't think there's anything stretched here. I don't think anyone's grasping at straws to see how this is put together. It fits very, very well. But notice also down there in chapter 7, I have introduction 2 written, and you say, well, what on earth does that mean? How can there be two introductions? Well, again, there are two basic parts to this book. There is the historical narrative. There are the apocalyptic visions. And almost all of the apocalyptic visions are very specific. It's only the first one that is this kind of broad view picture of the four kingdoms and the world history. And then it narrows to Greece, or to Persia and Greece. And then it narrows even more into Greece. And then it narrows even more into Antiochus the Fourth in particular, who's going to be talked about a fair amount there. And so it just gets more and more narrow as it goes on. And so this first one is kind of our introduction to this kind of vision and this kind of picture of world history. And then what you have is chapter 8, which deals with Persia and Greece, chapters 10 through 12, which is one vision. It's just the longest one. And so they had to, this is the one spot where you can quibble about chapter divisions in Daniel. Everything else in Daniel is a really good chapter division. So you don't have to hear me say that all class long. Bad chapter division. They're really good. 10 through 12 is one vision. If you don't put chapter divisions there, it's going to be an insanely long chapter. So, you know, quibble or not about that one. But chapter 8 and chapter 10 through 12, each is one vision about Persia and Greece. And chapter 9, the focal point of this last one is the restoration of God's people in Jerusalem. And so you've got these two chiasms that kind of overlap with each other as well when you stop and you think about it, because the end of one is the beginning of the next. And what you wind up with also, if you look at this in the linguistic side of things, is you've got a Hebrew prologue to an Aramaic chiasm and an Aramaic prologue to a Hebrew chiasm as well. Now, again, what's our theory of some old legends about about this guy named Daniel and then this later history posing as prophecy thing? That's not what this is going to look like. It wouldn't be put together this way at all. I'll show you a quote about that sort of thing here in a few minutes. Again, the chiasms overlap the language break, the chiasms overlap the genre break, and it overlaps itself because the last piece of the first chiasm is the first piece of the second chiasm. The introduction to that. All right, I'll stop there for a second, because that's a lot of structure and that sort of thing, which either just fascinates you or bores you, and I don't know that there's much in between. So I'll stop for a second. Questions about that or anything else along these lines? Yeah, Stephen? Yes. So our manuscripts on Daniel go back to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Those are the oldest ones that we have. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Aramaic section is there in Aramaic. So it's not something that got translated oddly at some point along the way, unless it happened pre-Dead Sea Scrolls. So yeah, that is a good question, and that is correct. If you didn't catch that, the question was, is the language division consistent in all of the manuscripts that we have? Yes, Savannah?
So the language,
could it be that he was writing from earlier and he was writing Hebrew and then it was time different and then he wrote Arabic and then it changed rulers? Yeah, that's the thing, is we can theorize, hypothesize a whole lot, and I don't know that we're ever going to come to a definite conclusion. It could be something along the lines of, this book was definitely not written all at once unless it was written all at once at the very end of Daniel's life. This book begins when he's a young man being carried off into captivity and ends, you know, 80 years later. We picture Daniel in the lion's den because of children's stories as much as anything. We picture Daniel as this little kid being thrown into the lion's den. By that point, Daniel's like 85 or something. He is a very, very old man. They throw him in, and he's probably break a hip before the lions get him. The picture that we have in our mind of that story is inaccurate, if the way we kind of stereotypically think about it. So it's a very, very long period of time. What happens in the process, it may have something to do with why it's written the way that it is in terms of language, or it may not. We just can't know. Andrew? That's
just going back to an old language. You said Aramaic became so popular. It seems a little weird as well.
Yeah, I would need to look more into that before I could answer definitively. That's a really good question. The question, again, if you didn't hear that, was, correct me if I'm abbreviating this in an incorrect way, but weren't the Maccabeans speaking Aramaic, so why would they have written this in Hebrew if... Yeah, if that part was written that late, according to that liberal critical theory. And I'm pretty sure, this is, again, what I need to verify, I'm pretty sure that most of the Maccabean stuff, they're pretty much all Aramaic at that point as well, but I'm not certain on that. So that would be an interesting thing to look at. Why would they jump back to Hebrew if they were doing that? I guess to trick people or something. Part of the deception. All right, well, let's talk about the structure of just chapters 2 through 7. And there have been a couple of different suggestions posed for this. I think one of them is more convincing than the other. I'll show you both of them just so I can say that I did, and I'll leave it with you to think about whether one is more convincing, the other is more convincing. You don't find either of them convincing, or you like them both. And again, it's just, it's a question of, are we trying to find too much here, or is the book that artistically put together? And some of it, you can still see how it would work out. Chapters 2 and 5, chapter 2 is Nebuchadnezzar's dream, chapter 5 is the handwriting on the wall, show us a God who reveals things. And those words in quotation marks, tell, interpret, reveal, make known, show the interpretation, make known, and interpret, are either conceptual synonyms or they are verbatim. Most of the time they're verbatim in both chapters. Those words show up in each of those chapters, which kind of help tie them together. So a God who reveals things. In chapters 3 and 6, which was parallel in the other structure as well, by the way, so this is still that very strong one of the fiery furnace and the lion's den, the God who rescues, and you've got rescue and save showing up, and the idea of deliverance showing up in chapter 3 as well. And then chapters 4 and 7, the God who rules, where you've got rules and kingdoms and dominion, dominion, throne, and kingdom showing up in the latter chapter. So chapter 4 is where Nebuchadnezzar is humbled, and that very famous phrase from the book of Daniel gets repeated 3 times in that chapter, then it shows up once again in chapter 5 as a specific quotation of chapter 4, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. What is chapter 7? It's that first apocalyptic vision where you've got all these monsters, and they're terrifying, and they're taking over the world, and then the Ancient of Days shows up, and that's the end of them, and he gives the kingdom to the Son of Man who rules forever. And so God, as one who rules, certainly is a theme in both of those chapters. Whether this is an intentional structural element, the concepts hold up very well. God is one who reveals, rescues, and rules. And hey, look, they all start with R too, so that's fantastic. Nice mnemonic device. It's there. Whether it's an intentional structure is hard to say. Let me show you one more, then I'll come back to you, Stephen. Is it about that specifically?
No.
Okay. So the other one that I've seen, and I think this is probably the weakest proposed one, the most dubious of all of them, but that's my opinion, has them in pairs, where you've got the rule of Babylon emphasized in chapters 2 and 3, its temporary nature in chapter 2, its tyrannical nature in chapter 3. Chapters 4 and 5, again, these were paralleled in that first structure. So the proud king, the one who learns and is humbled, the other who is too stupid to learn, and so he is humbled. Those do fit together very well. And then the faithfulness, where in chapter 6 there is suffering connected to faithfulness. Faithfulness doesn't get you out of suffering. Faithfulness very often puts you in it. So whether it's the lion's den in chapter 6 or the fact that the righteous will suffer for a period of time in chapter 7, again, the concepts are there, whether it's intentional or not is, I think, the big question. So what do we do with all of this? I'll put that back up there if you're copying that down in a second. This is what Dale Davis says. I always tend to associate sophisticated and conscious literary design with one originating artistic mind rather than with an illusory committee making contributions over the centuries. So the idea that Daniel was just kind of, you know, over a long period of time, editorial process, you know, patchwork together doesn't make sense. Whether you've got these random legends about this guy named Daniel and someone else throwing together this fake prophecy and, you know, sticks that together in two parts, that none of that fits with what you actually see in Daniel, which is a marvelously constructed book as far as that goes. All right, Stephen? Okay. Thank you. Anything else while I'm... Yeah, Gwen.
While we're turning to the language.
Yeah.
I know when he talked about the Cluster of Hebrews, he talked about, like, why he doesn't think it was written by Paul because of, like, the quality of the Greek in it. And I was wondering if there's anything you could say about, like...
Oh, the quality of the Aramaic? No. No, there's nothing I can say about that. Yeah, no, that is one of those things that, you know, if you know the language well enough to comment on those things. I mean, to kind of broaden this out a little bit more to just talk about this idea, One of the reasons why there's debate over the authorship of 1st and 2nd Peter is because they're very different in their style of Greek. And I think the best explanation is that Peter either wrote one of them with a scribe or wrote both of them, but with two different scribes. And that would explain that very easily. And we know they used scribes for their writing back then, at least some of the time. So I think there are ways of dealing with that sort of thing. But as to the nature of the Aramaic here and what that points us toward, I mean, there's a little bit that can be said about that kind of thing, at least that I've come across in my own studies, about the nature of the Aramaic in terms of the date of it being written. Maybe we'll come back to some of that in a later class. You'll be gone, won't you? Yeah, you had this class. That's a question. No. The Aramaic would, from what I remember about the date issue, it would be some of the Aramaic seems to be pre-Maccabean era. But linguistic arguments for date are dubious in general. Adam? Yeah, I mean, that certainly is a possibility. And that may be, for that matter, you know, why does 2 through 7 have its own kind of structure? Like I said, one of the theories that people have posed is that it was circulated as its own unit, apart from the front and back. And that certainly is a possibility. Here you've got this section that is structurally its own unit, as far as that goes, and it's written in a language that could be passed around as its own tract. Hesitate to call the book of the Bible a tract. Awful thing to say about the Bible. But, in terms of having a little small section of text to share with your Persian neighbor or whatever, Daniel 2 through 7 could do that job. That's a possibility, is that it was a separate piece of Daniel that was intended to be circulated to a broader audience than just the Jewish people. And I think it's also helpful along those lines, maybe not quite exactly along those lines, but we need to remember as well, it's easy to say some things like, Daniel and Ezekiel were written for the diaspora audience because they're over there in Babylon, and Jeremiah was written for the Jewish audience because he's back there at home. And there is some, at least initial truth to that. In terms of prophets, Ezekiel was prophesying over there, and Jeremiah was prophesying on the other side. But let's not forget how much back and forth there is between Jerusalem and Babylon. We see that in Nehemiah. We see that in Jeremiah. We see that in Isaiah, even before the Babylonians take over. So there's a lot of back and forth, and who knows how much of the book of Daniel was going back and forth, not just to his audience here, but back to Jerusalem as well. Yeah, is that over in chapter 4? And so this chapter 4 could have been its own little piece that went out as well, as far as that goes. King Nebuchadnezzar to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. It reads like a royal decree going out, and it will end in that first person as well. The middle of it's third person. So again, did he write the whole thing, or did he take the story and put the beginning and end, and so we just don't know all the details. But yeah, it's possible that went out as its own piece to a more public audience too. So I think we just, what we need to get away from is the idea that the only way something can be inspired is if, God took someone over or God whispered directly into their ear what to write, and the same exact person wrote every single word one after the other from beginning to end all at the same time. And if it's not that, it's not inspired. And if we say it's not that, we're denying the doctrine of inspiration. Well, that puts God in a pretty small box if we tell God what he can and can't do. The book of Psalms is clearly written over a very long period of time. We know that the earliest one that we can date is Moses, and the latest one that we can date is in the exile. And there are some that we can't date, which may have been before or after either of those time periods, but we just don't know. When was it all put together in its final form? I don't know. Not just the words in it, but the selection of those 150 psalms inspired? I believe it was. Same thing with Proverbs. When was Proverbs written? Well, we've got Solomon that wrote a bunch, and then these are the ends of the Proverbs of Solomon. And then there are some that seem to be by anonymous wise people that aren't connected with Solomon. Then, hey, look, Hezekiah found some more of Solomon's Proverbs, and these are the ones that were collected by Hezekiah's people. And then you've got the words of Agur and the words of Lemuel. Again, how did all of that, well, it happened however it happened, but that doesn't mean it wasn't inspired. So is it possible that Nebuchadnezzar wrote a chunk, 2 through 7 was a circulating chunk, and someone came along later and wrote down the story of Daniel? Daniel had his own visions, which was a chunk, and someone came and put all of this together in its final form, and that whole thing is inspired? Of course that's possible. Let's not limit God by our own theories of what we think inspiration should be. And I think that's probably the bigger point on the theological side, I guess, making sure we're not, you know, practicing bad theology, thinking wrong kinds of things about God, limiting Him. Anytime we think we have God figured out, it's probably our first clue that we're wrong. We know everything there is to know about Him. No, not a chance. Just remember, He is always far bigger and greater than we can possibly imagine. And so anytime we put Him in a box, we're on the wrong path. Colleen? Yeah, I have not looked into much depth on them, but yeah, if you've heard of Targums or Targumim before, a Targum is basically an ancient Jewish commentary, written in Aramaic almost always. They are alternately enlightening and infuriating. They will sometimes take 5 pages to say what I could have said in one sentence. And sometimes they will say something that you'll say, how have I never seen that? That's the most brilliant thing I've ever read in my life. So they're a mixed bag in terms of reading them, which is part of why I don't do that a lot. I like to read things that have already done all that work and found the good stuff for me. But I've not read a whole lot about Daniel. Was it the question of what they said about?
Well, I'm just curious of what their take on it.
Oh, okay.
How
it was put together and those kinds of things? Yeah, I don't know if they talk much about that or not. That's an interesting question. Most of my experience with rabbinic writings in that sort of genre is more of just dealing with the text and dealing with what Rabbi so-and-so said and those kinds of things.
Like they would have a comment or something about why the book changes languages.
Yeah, I'll have to look and see. I don't know if they do or not. All right. One other thing to say is, on top of all of the rest of it, we also have overlapping chronologies. The book of Daniel is chronologically sequenced, sort of. What I mean by that is chapters 1 through 6 are chronological, and chapters 7 through 12 are chronological, but they overlap with one another. So chapters 1 through 6 run from Nebuchadnezzar through Darius the Mede, which is 605 to 538, more or less. 605 is a pretty hard date for when it begins. It's the 538 date. It's 538, 539, 537. Somewhere in that general vicinity is what chapter 6, 1 through 6 run. When you hit chapter 7, you jump back. And so it's the beginning of Belshazzar's time, who is the last Babylonian king. He's co-regent with his father, which is a few years before Darius the Mede, who is the one in chapter 6 of the Persians. And so you jump back about 12 years, and then you will continue on until a couple of years after the end of chapter 6. And so they're both chronological, but there's a jump back when you get to chapter 7 in terms of time. So the entire book of Daniel spans from 605 to 536. Notice what I was saying earlier about Daniel being old. In chapter 6 earlier. Chapter 1, he's taken as a teen, roughly speaking, in 605, and it is, 67 years later that he's being thrown into the lion's den. So much, much different picture than we get in kids' books with the illustrations of Daniel the 7-year-old petting a lion. All right. All of that said, what I want to think about as we bring this class to a close is what the book of Daniel is about. And the way that I want to go about this is talking about Daniel in terms of the big picture of the message of Daniel by looking at the message of each unit. And because it is, for the most part, self-contained units, chapter 1 is its own historical story, its own narrative. Chapter 2 is its own narrative. And there is building and there are connections, of course. But any one of those is a pretty good standalone unit all on its own. So you can look at each chapter and each vision at the end and say, what's the point of this? What's the story? What's the message? What's happening here? And so I'm going to run you through what I think are some good, as far as you can do in a sentence, some pretty decent chapter summaries, and then open the floor to see what you would say the big picture theme of the entire book of Daniel is. And then if you don't get it right, I'll tell you what the right answer is after our discussion. All right, so Daniel chapter 1, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in captivity. They reject a better diet, undeniably a better diet to accomplish what the king is trying to accomplish. We'll talk about that next week. And instead of failing, they succeed because God blesses them. That's chapter 1. Chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the dream of the statue made of the different metals. You remember that one? Only God can reveal the meaning of this dream. And the point of the dream is that human kingdoms will fall and God's kingdom will remain and will be the supreme kingdom. And that point of only God being able to reveal its meaning is emphasized there in the chapter in a couple of different ways, including the Babylonian pagan magicians who say only the gods can do this. They're right. They're just wrong about who the God is and whether or not he will. They say, you know, only the gods can do this and he's nowhere to be found. And Daniel says, well, yeah, only God can do that, and he's always nearby. So it's a very different kind of message, but the point is there all the way through. Only God can reveal the meaning of this dream. Daniel chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse to bow to the statue. They're thrown into the fiery furnace, and they're delivered by the power of God, which Nebuchadnezzar clearly sees and makes one of his great statements about the nature of this God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We'll talk about those various confessions as we move through the book as well. Chapter 4 is Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation. The point of this chapter is clear because it's said three times, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of man and gives it to whom he wills. If that's not the point of this chapter, I don't know what the point of the chapter is, because again, it's said three times, and the chapter seems pretty clearly what that is being driven at here. Chapter 5, the handwriting on the wall, where it is repeated. Didn't you learn the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar learned? That the Most High rules the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom he will. So again, seems to be a point here as well. Also, you've got this judgment on Babylon by God in chapter 5 there as Babylon falls to Persia. Chapter 6 is Daniel in the lion's den, which emphasizes there that as Daniel is true to God, God delivers Daniel from the lions and impresses this Persian king the way that the Babylonian kings had been impressed previously. I'll put some of these back up. If you're copying these down, I want to leave space. I'll flip it back to that other slide while we're having our discussion. Daniel 7, the vision of the four kingdoms, the four crazy animals that come up out of the sea, and then the arrival of the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man, which emphasizes the rule of God there again. Daniel chapter 8 is the vision of the ram and the goat, where there are it's the history of the Persians and the Greeks in more of a big picture, but what it's going to work its way down toward is the struggles of God's people in particular and the fact that God will deliver his people in these struggles. Daniel chapter 9 is the vision of the 77s, the prayer of Daniel, and here what is emphasized is that despite future difficulties, God will overcome. And God is going to restore his people, and he is going to send his anointed one, is going to be emphasized there in Daniel 9 as well. And finally, the last vision, Daniel 10 through 12, where you see that God is in control of all history, including the difficult times, that he is going to overcome, even to the point of the resurrection of the dead, when you get to Daniel chapter 12. And including in the face of one of the most violent enemies the people of God will ever see, there in the person of Antiochus IV in the Seleucid time period, who gets a lot of emphasis in the book of Daniel. God is in control of that too, and God's going to bring him down when the time is right for God to do that. So there is our sketch of the book of Daniel in, you know, 1 to 2 line summaries. Obviously, there's a whole lot more to be said about each of those chapters, but I hope that's a good big picture view. So, with that given, then, what would you say is the prevailing theme or themes of the book of Daniel?
God's got a plan and he's in control.
Okay, God's got a plan and God's in control. The problem with having a discussion about this is the answer's too obvious and there's not a whole lot of discussion to be had, right? Yeah, David?
There's a heavy emphasis on the pride of kings.
Okay.
Which, of course, would contrast with God's.
Yeah. So, yeah, you've got, in particular, Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar's pride emphasized there in chapters 4 and 5. But what I didn't emphasize is as you get down here to Daniel 10 through 12 and a little bit in chapter 8 as well, Antiochus, the pride of Antiochus, which is going to show there too, and that would fit into that theme as well. So human kingdoms lift themselves up and God puts them down. That idea would certainly fit this as well. That would fit with the statue dream also. That fits with the vision of the beasts and the Ancient of Days coming along and, you know, thumping all of them. Yeah. Yeah, Andrew?
I think one thing is that there's, at least that I see, there's ups and downs for all people, faithful or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
You have the fact that Nebuchadnezzar was given the kingdom in the first place and was made this powerful. God did that. He wasn't faithful, but God still did that for him. But and while there are ups and downs for each, there's only deliverance for the faithful
yeah.
in the end.
Yeah, in the end, there's deliverance. And that part is and you're not going to be delivered unless you're facing something bad too, right? That's one of the great lessons of the fiery furnace, where they're thrown in, and it's when they're thrown in that they see the fourth man. You know, God doesn't spare them from the fire. He spares them in the fire. He joins them in the fire. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. You don't get delivered unless there's something to be delivered from. And so the suffering of God's people, right at the beginning of the book, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, some of the vessels from the temple. Where does the book begin? It begins with the suffering of God's people. And that's where it's going to continue, really, through much of this book, is this suffering of God's people. It happens, but they're delivered because God is in control. What else? Yeah, Dan?
Could the Aramaic Hebrew be the restoration, a picture of the restoration? You have God's people, you have the judgment upon the people, and then you have the restoration.
Yeah, that's a good thought, is that the language change fits that story of Daniel as well, that, you know, you're getting down to 10 through 12, which is where you've got this little mini chiasm at the end that centers on the restoration of Jerusalem and God's people, that the language change fits that basic story. It begins with God's people, chapter 1, the prologue of the book. It ends with God's people, the restoration of them. And the middle section has to do with all of these world kingdoms and God being in control in spite of all of it. What else? Anything else? Oh, I said I was going to go back, didn't I? I should have done that a second ago. Now I'm ready to move forward. Well, one of the things that is interesting... Are you going to say something, Adam?
Well, just considering what the Jews were going to have to live through, and that's why I guess it goes along with everything. So, encouragement, don't be afraid.
Yeah. And there's a tendency, I think, I don't know if I want to say there's a tendency in people. I think there's a tendency in very comfortable American people, if nothing else, to want to ask why when bad things happen. And maybe that's universal, maybe it's not. But that certainly, I think, is at least within our culture a tendency. Why is this happening? Well, one of the answers is because God is in control and he knows what he's doing. And that's not always the easiest thing to accept, but that is the biblical answer. And that's definitely the answer of the book of Daniel as well, is that God is in control and God knows what he's doing. and as bad as it gets during the time of Antiochus, as those people are going through that, they can look at Daniel and say, God knew this was coming, and God was in control of all of this, and God's going to solve this in his own time. I don't think it's an accident that it's during this exact period of time where this genre that shows up in Daniel 7 through 12 suddenly explodes in Hebrew writing. It's because they've been reading the book of Daniel a whole lot. They start writing like it. This era that this book is prophesying is when that comes up yet again. So this is how I'm going to put it. And I think everything that was said really is along these same lines. But just to make it, nice and concise for you perhaps. I think you can talk about this in terms of a principle and the practical outgrowth of that. And so the principle is, I'll just quote the book of Daniel and say, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of man. I really think that everything that happens in the book of Daniel can come back to this. God is in control. Chapter 1, we're going to see it explicitly 3 times. God is in control in that chapter. And then, of course, it's not quoted in chapter 1, but 3 times in chapter 4, this is the quote. Shows up in chapter 5, but all of it. God is in control. And what that means, practically speaking, is that in spite of present appearances, God is in control and he will win the victory. It doesn't matter how bad things look right now. God is the one who is in charge because he's the one who rules. And so whatever happens in our lives, whether we're delivered from the fire or thrown in the fire, whether we're delivered from the lion's den or thrown in the lion's den, whether we escape Antiochus or he, you know, runs us through, it really doesn't matter because God is in control and he can rescue even from death. And so he will win the victory, and his people will win the victory with him. And the book of Daniel talks about this on at least 3 levels. And makes the point in different ways. He is in control in terms of the individual level, when Daniel's thrown in, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are thrown in, when they are rejecting one food and eating another. God is in control in the individual level. God is in control at the national level, whether it is Babylon or Persia or Greece or Rome or anyone else. God is in control. He makes kingdoms rise. He makes kingdoms fall. And then God is in control on the cosmic level as well. And so when there is the prince of Persia, this evil spiritual force that is withstanding an angel of God and trying to bring a message to Daniel, Michael shows up and helps him out and sends him along his way. And if you don't remember that, I promise that's actually in the Bible. We'll get to that as we move through the book. But at the cosmic level, God is in control. The cosmic level, God rules. And the book of Daniel then becomes such an incredibly comforting and encouraging book, not just a great book of kids' stories. Because this is the message that runs through it from cover to cover. All right, I'm past time, so I'll stop, and we'll begin in chapter 1 next time.